Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
What's up, Internet? Welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devinder Hardwar.
I'm Deputy Editor Sherlyn Lowe.
This week, we're going to be diving into some video game news. There are more rumors around the PlayStation 5 Pro, which seems like it could actually be coming this year. And we'll be talking about the Playdate as well, 2 years after the release of that thing, with Engadget Senior Editor Jessica Condit. So stay tuned. There's a bunch of gaming stuff to dive into. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes and drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. We also recently started doing our live streams Thursday mornings around 10:30 a.m. Eastern on our YouTube channel. So join in for that. You can talk with the crowd. We'll do some Q&A, and you can actually see us show off gadgets once in a while. So it's a fun time. Stop by. Joining us to talk about everything that's great with video games and not so great these days is Jessica Condit, Senior Editor in Engadget. Hey, Jess, how's it going?
Hello. Happy to be here. It's not too bad
right
now.
Happy to have you back.
It's not too bad in video games. Like, that was very depressing, but it is okay, I promise.
It was pretty, I mean, it was pretty bad. We're going to talk about highs and lows and midpoints happening here. Nice to have Jess back on the live stream.
Yay!
And everything, too. So cool. It's cool. It's so cool to see faces and get everybody out here. I want to talk about these PS5 Pro rumors, Jess, because we saw a couple of reports from The Verge this week saying, hey, yes, it's definitely happening. Developers are actually being courted right now. People can order dev kits, specifically developers, not normal people. But the rules for what you can do with a game, like basically any game coming after August, they want it to be PlayStation 5 Pro enhanced. This thing sounds like it's going to have a slightly, like negligibly slightly faster CPU, maybe 10%, but a much faster GPU. And that should allow for better 4K gaming, better ray tracing too, at those things. So how do you feel about this, Jess? We're 4 years on from the launch of the PlayStation 5.
Right.
You know, is this about time for a mid-cycle refresh, you think?
Well, isn't that weird that it's been 4 years already?
It feels so weird. Yes.
I know. And we're not the only people that feel like that. I've had conversations about that with a lot of people where it does not feel like it's been 4 years since these consoles came out. But yeah, it has. And we're due for a refresh. So yeah, this is Sony doing the standard console upgrade cycle thing where we're going to get a more powerful PS5. Slightly faster CPU, faster GPU. That's all good. We're going to get some like built-in, not DLSS, but like built-in proprietary DLSS built on AMDs.
Sony's upscaling type of stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
So that'll be cool. And then the enhanced games are going to have to actually like, if you want the enhanced label on PS5 for developers, you're going to have to like actually rebuild your game based on this new hardware, on the new architecture. You can't just like have a slightly better resolution or a slightly better frame rate and they won't give you the enhanced version for that. Like the label means something. So that's kind of cool. But like, yeah, I guess we're waiting for The Last of Us Part 2 remastered enhanced version now. Like, I don't know.
I want to buy that game, like, yeah, for the 10th time at this point.
Exactly.
You were saying it's a standard upgrade, Jess, but I do want to say, like, this is not normal. Like, when the PlayStation 4 Pro and the Xbox One X and One S happened, that wasn't normal. It was just because we were at a weird point where those original consoles launched when the like 2012-ish, like the early, basically 4K TVs were early at that point. Fast forward a couple of years and people want higher like quality 4K stuff. They want better performance. Yeah. And the GPU hardware also had a big leap over those few years too. So there was clearly room to do something slightly more powerful within the same architecture that they had for those consoles without doing an entirely new console. And that's what we got with those systems. And they were, I don't know, as a PC gamer too, like I could see the need for that because console hardware is locked in. You can't do much with it. The Nintendo Switch is so old. Like the hardware in that is so old, but games are still coming out and looking cool on it and great on it. But consoles are locked down. There's not much room to play here. So this is where the PlayStation 5 Pro comes in.
Well, yeah.
Has Microsoft said, it feels like Microsoft has been saying they don't want to play this exact game.
Exactly. So this is interesting because right now Xbox, the Xbox Series X is the most powerful console on the market, right? That's Xbox's thing. They've been very, very vocal about that, very happy. This PS5 Pro is going to blow that out of the water. So Microsoft will not be able to say we have the most powerful console this generation. And I think that's kind of savvy by Sony. If they're gonna keep building consoles, if they're gonna keep doing this, they're gonna be the company that says, no, we're still building high-powered consoles for the living room, traditional style, that's what we like. They're leaning into it. I love that. Because Microsoft is, like, kind of as you alluded to, this time around for their refresh, they're gonna go a little underpowered. They're gonna go reduced power slightly, but no disk drive, you know, for the Series X. Like, that's kind of what we've seen of their plans for a refresh. So yeah, I see Microsoft, and I know that this is contentious. A lot of people don't want Microsoft to exit the console business. I do not think Microsoft will ever...
They shall not be named.
I don't think Microsoft will ever stop making hardware, but this traditional console thing, they are building a whole ecosystem that does not include high-powered hardware. And like that's what they're doing. Cloud gaming, all these different screens, Xbox everywhere. This console thing isn't really for Xbox. I know that they're saying, at this point, they're saying their next-gen console is going to be the most powerful. They're really leaning into consoles still. I personally don't buy it. I think something's going to change. I think there's going to be some like, oh, we had to change our plans and now we're not doing that. Mm-hmm. I really think that's going to happen. So
I kind of hope they do.
Yeah,
because
me too.
It seems like chasing raw power is a fool's errand, especially for Microsoft, because like I was there, like we reviewed these things together, Jess, and Microsoft was like, our box is the best, it's the fastest, we win, QED, that's it. And then meanwhile somebody's out here like, we got games you want to play, Spider-Man's, multiple Spider-Man's, we've got Last of Us remakes, we've got like so many things and actual exclusive for the PlayStation 5. And I don't know what it was, but Microsoft just kept taking like L after L after L this generation, right? Halo was delayed. All the big flagship games were kind of disappointments, right?
Yeah. And they are focusing on acquiring studios. Microsoft is becoming just a mega publisher. They're becoming a huge segment of the gaming output every year. Sony also owns a lot of studios, like close to 20, I want to say. So like, yeah, Sony also is playing this game, but Microsoft is playing it harder than anyone. They're leaning into software. And like, sure, I love the Xbox controller. Like this is what I play with on Steam. I play with a little Xbox controller. Like, I think they're going to keep making hardware because they do some things very well and they make money off of those things. But high-powered consoles, I think that's Sony's game. And I like that. I like this move from Sony to release a high-powered mid-cycle refresh.
This is just like hardware chess, right? Like, you don't know what the other person's going to play. And Sony's like, okay, extra fast hardware. And Microsoft's like, okay. Cloud gaming, distributed infrastructure,
We'll just buy the whole industry.
yeah, exactly. Nintendo's off in its own, like, Nintendo's over there playing Go, like, by itself, because nobody's playing what Nintendo's playing. So that's my bias. So, like, I always kind of like what they're thinking.
Me too.
Nintendo, not a perfect company. They're out there also suing emulator makers and whatnot, but as like a philosophical thing.
No, yeah. I've thought about Nintendo a lot. If we want to do a quick side tangent.
Yes, please.
Layoffs are a choice. They're built into the cycle in the US especially and in Western nations. But Japan, Nintendo, like Nintendo has not laid anyone off. Not on the scale they have. They have issues with contractors. I totally understand that. But generally, Nintendo avoids layoffs. Like, CEOs take a cut. They just kind of, they do their own thing. And I really appreciate that. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Respect to Nintendo.
We talked about the story a couple of years ago too. Like amidst, like it was as the pandemic was happening, Nintendo gave people raises, right? Like they actually invested more in people rather than being like, we're going to devalue you and make you feel bad about where you're working and the state of the industry and whatever. So yeah, shout out to Nintendo for that. But okay, so everybody is kind of playing a different game now, right? Like, because Microsoft has a bunch of studios. We're still waiting for the games to really hit.
Yes, we are.
We're also still waiting for cloud gaming to really be a thing. Like they had talked about doing like a separate Xbox, like cloud dongle or something, like a Game Pass streaming dongle. And I think the news was that is not happening, as I recall correctly.
Oh,
I don't know.
I don't know what the latest update was, but I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, right? Mm-hmm.
But if they, like, that's a whole thing. It's tough to rely on because it's dependent on your internet. It's dependent on so many things. But if they could just, like, make a little $50, $75 thing that plugs into your TV, but also comes with the controller that's already paired with it and does, like, a lot of the legwork to get you connected with the assumption that everybody, that people have good enough internet, that could be cool. Because I've done a bunch of, like, Xbox cloud gaming while traveling and stuff, and it's a really nice thing to have, have access to when you don't have your console around. I almost think like Sony, Jess, is doing what Sony did with like CRT TVs, right? Like we own this market. We're just going to run it into the ground. We're not going to really lay any groundwork for the future of where gaming or consoles may be going. Like they only just recently started doing more PC releases, which again was like something Microsoft was thinking about broadly for a long time because they are PC. So tied to PCs and everything. Like philosophically, I feel like Sony is the most successful one right now and the one that's going to milk the console market the most. But Nintendo's thinking separately. Microsoft is thinking like deeply into the future, which may never arrive. But I don't know. It's kind of an interesting point, I guess. Yeah,
that makes sense to me because we do have to remember like Microsoft kind of has an outsized presence in the US, especially in the console conversation. Like Xboxes don't really sell very well outside of the US. They're like, Xbox is losing the console race in terms of sales numbers. It's no contest. So like Xbox truly does not have as much invested. Like they won't see as much return from a company as a company like Sony from building a high powered console. And I think that's really starting to like kind of feel real to Xbox in a way where they have to look at the future and say, what are we doing here? Mark my words, I've made the prediction that high-powered console, I don't think it's going to show up from Xbox.
I mean, that's probably a good bet, but my prediction is, like, even if it does show up, like, that is the wrong move, right? Because they kind of, you got to do something different, you got to do something to excite people about games, you have to actually get games that are interesting to people again.
Release your games. I'm waiting for this Compulsion Games game that's been coming out forever. We saw just a teaser of it. Like, there's so many studios that have just kind of disappeared into Microsoft recently, so I don't love that.
I almost wonder, like, do you think, Jess, like, would Microsoft just be like, okay, let's just cut out of this generation a little early, like what they did with the Xbox 360, right? Like I feel like Microsoft keeps wanting to go back to that move where they basically preempted Sony. They released something super quick, super innovative. Like the Xbox 360 really brought online gaming to consoles in a way that the the PlayStation 3 certainly did not. And they kind of owned that generation.
And they had indie games.
They had indie games.
Yeah.
And Microsoft got so complacent so quickly. Like, they just did full Microsoft. This box is now the Xbox One. Everything in your home. It's your kitchen sink. It's your refrigerator. It's everything. And it was a failure because it immediately turned everybody off. And it was $100 more expensive than the PlayStation 4, too. Like, talk about hubris, I guess.
It felt like Microsoft didn't know what its audience wanted for quite a while, right? Like, leaning into, we can have live sports on your Xbox. And it's like, okay. Like, yeah, we can have Netflix, like, literally built into my TV. You don't need to highlight that during your showcase, dude.
You could plug your cable box into your Xbox.
Yeah,
don't
right?
We all want to do that?
Thanks, Phil.
I covered the launch of the Xbox One as well. I was like, it's just watching a company do the dumbest things possible over and over again. And like, the people in charge were just so clueless about it. My crazy idea, though, Jess, for like a Microsoft box. And listeners, let me know what you think. $500, $400 gaming box. Mm-hmm. That's it.
That's the pitch.
Well, that's the pitch, but it's a Windows box.
Mm.
It's a PC.
It's a Steam box.
So
it's a Steam machine.
It's a Steam box. So it has the Xbox layer, or you reboot, you put Windows on it, and you could play all the PC games with decent hardware. Like, I don't know.
Okay.
Is that crazy? I feel like there's a market for that, for people who don't want to deal with gaming PCs.
It's an OUYA not running Android. It's a Steam machine not running Steam. I like where this is going, but both of those products failed miserably that I just referenced.
Absolutely.
So I don't know if the market is actually there for that. Like, I hear you. I think that kind of pitch made sense back when, like, OUYA was coming out too.
But,
like,
no
one bought that.
Yeah.
So, but hey, at least we got Towerfall out of OUYA. So there's that.
At least we got Towerfall. I have my OUYA here collecting dust. What a mess. Well, let's talk about, like, speaking about, like, unique consoles doing interesting things. You wrote about the Playdate 2 years later, Jess, and you still love this thing. I'm amazed. Like, I loved your piece. Everybody go check it out. You also did a video for it. But broadly, can you tell us, how do you feel about the Playdate now, 2 years after it was released?
Yeah, I guess as an intro, I love the Playdate. I love this thing. I call it a little inspiration machine in my retrospective that we just published. And I am so pleased at how Panic has allowed this ecosystem to grow. Like, first of all, Playdate, tiny yellow handheld with a 1-bit screen. There's a little crank on the side. Otherwise, it just has standard, like, Game Boy face buttons. And the simplicity of it, but also just, like, how cleanly everything's been implemented, the care that you can feel that's gone into this thing. It's provided an actual platform for indie developers to just kind of express some creativity in new ways, right? This crank changes kind of everything. You can do so many different things with it. Or you can use it minimally and still have a really cool game on Playdate.
It reminds me of, like, the Minions thing, the claw, except the crank.
The crank.
It's essentially, that's the ad for the Playdate, the crank. What the can crank. You do with a crank? Yes.
You know, it's like the crank kind of isn't even, I don't know, it doesn't feel weird very quickly. It doesn't feel weird.
Yeah, yeah,
it's just integrated into this thing, and it's just part of the Playdate. It's just how these games play. But, like, I have so many different styles of games. I'm looking, like, through my little library here. There's so many different styles of games on here. And the fun, the innovation that's happening on this little thing, I understand these games are not going to define the next generation of gaming. But I think the ideas that developers are getting by messing around with Playdate, we're going to see in AAA games. Like, we're going to see in hit indie titles. Like, this is just like we talked about Towerfall on OUYA. It was just a platform for an awesome game. And there are 181 games built into Playdate in the catalog that you can buy now, which is, like, awesome. That's kind of grown over the past year. And then there are over 800 games on itch.io for Playdate, tagged Playdate on itch.io. So,
that's,
like,
amazing.
There's a vibrant community here. And I don't know, it's just a really kind of special little niche of gamers just making really weird stuff that I've never seen anywhere before. People are excited. It's just a fun place to be. I love Playdate.
It took, like, a unique company also to make that happen, right? Like, Panic, the developers of Firewatch.
The publishers.
When they announced this,
publishers of Firewatch.
The publishers, yeah. When they announced this thing, we were all like, huh, it's a Game Boy with a crank. With a crank.
But then you
crank.
Hear Teenage Engineering is helping design it, and
yes.
You're like, ah, lovely. And that's, it feels like a good product, right?
I buy Teenage Engineering hardware just to look at it. I have, like, a PC case that they designed at some point. It's just, it's cool looking hardware, but it does cool stuff. I feel like a normal company, like a public company with public investors and everything, could not do something like this, whereas Panic has the room to kind of experiment with hardware, deal with some of the failure, like some issues, like there were flaws early on with the batteries. They're not selling a ton of these things, but they're selling enough for it to be a vibrant community. And that seems like that's it. That's good. That's all they want. They don't want, like, hyperscale growth like everybody else, it seems.
Exactly. Exactly. And, like, that's the trap that I think, you know, the biggest companies, this is why I kind of rail against like AAA companies, the big ones, because once you get that big, you're just focused on making money. And Playdate is a product that isn't focused on making money, I gotta assume. They've sold about 70,000 of these, which is pretty good. They had pre-orders all filled up, and they shipped all those out, and now you can just order one. And there's a cover that they sell for $30. The whole device is $199. So, you know, reasonable, but I understand that that's kind of out of the range for some people who just kind of want a novelty gaming machine. I use it enough to make it worth
a lot of money.
It is. Yeah. It is.
The price went up too. It was $179 initially, right?
It was
a little lower. That's what I bought it at. But here's, like, I will admit this, Jess. Like, I had a lot of fun with the Playdate the first month, and then I checked back in, like, every couple months to see the new games trickle in. And I haven't looked at it since they had the storefront and everything. But for people who bought this thing and maybe have let it gather dust a bit, do you think it is worth, like, picking back up and diving into what they're doing?
Absolutely. If anything, Mars After Midnight is the kind of headlining game right now on Playdate. This is a game by Lucas Pope, the guy who did Papers, Please and Return of the Obra Dinn. Two incredible games, like truly, really cool. And his new game is only on Playdate, Mars After Midnight. It's so cute that you're letting Martians into a like community room on Mars, and you have to like make sure you get the right Martians. And it's all very cute. It's all very good. Papers, Please on Mars, you know.
That's cool. It's also like, that is such an indie developer move. Like, what can I do to make the least money possible with this project?
I love it.
Put it on a restricted platform with only 70,000 buyers.
You know, the best part about it is a developer that doesn't have to think about making money. just wants to make a game. Like, that's kind of what Playdate's all about. And it's pretty easy to get into. Like, you can download the SDK. You can sideload games. You can have the screen playing on your PC. So you can actually just play Playdate on your PC if the screen is not working for you for some reason. Like, it's a really well thought out machine. And like we were saying, maybe a public company wouldn't be able to do this. So like a company like Valve, they're making the Steam Deck, right? They're making a really high powered portable PC that's really done well that I also use a lot. They could do something like this, you know, but they're still kind of going standard hardware kind of stuff. Even Valve. And I like to see Panic doing something totally different and doing it well.
Yeah, to Valve's credit, like you've mentioned the Steam machines and everything, like they tried a couple of different things, right?
They had
Steam VR, you know, like they have tried all these different little bits of gaming that I feel like other companies just didn't want to fully invest in. So credit to them for that. But yeah, Valve could be doing so much more. Always. Also delivering more games too. Like that would be nice. So Playdate, I feel like there's still a major flaw for this thing, Jess. Like, for the amount of money it costs, there was no backlight on the screen, and it really brought me back to the days of, like, the original Game Boy and the original Game Boy Advance, which didn't have a backlight and just made it so tough to enjoy games in low lighting. So
we need those little neck lights again. I know. It's really upsetting. Like, that is the one thing that I do wish that it had a backlight, mm-hmm. right? I've been able to make it work. It's very sunny in Phoenix. But, like, yeah, if you can't play it, like, on a dark plane, that's where I want to play this. Because it fits in my pocket.
One or two LEDs. And a slight LED at the top, a small LED at the bottom.
I know. I feel like we could open this up and backlight it ourselves. But, you know, maybe that's, like, Playdate 2. I don't know.
Are there any, because I remember the Game Boy had like all these sorts of like external accessories or like a magnifying thing you could buy for your Game Boy that also had like a light to it. Has anybody made like cool little accessories for the Playdate?
No, but I've heard on the like on the forums and stuff that people are using neck lights and that's working really well for them, like reading like the ones that actually go around your neck. So I don't know. That's an option, but you don't want to have to buy an extra light to play, you know, the console that you just bought for $200. I totally get that. In most cases, the screen is visible and it's fine. But yeah, if it's dark, that is the downside.
I feel like, again, we keep trying to tempt Sherlyn with all sorts of gaming hardware. So Sherlyn, have you seen the Playdate?
Yeah.
Have you felt one yet?
Jess and I, when we hung out in person a while ago, she showed me the Playdate and it's cute as all heck. I want to play crank games. I want to play fishing games. What else can I do with it? I will say, Mark Dell in our, you know, live stream chat has a question for Jess, which is, how did Panic, the makers of some very good FTP software, manage to make their own hardware? But it sounds like they teamed up with Teenage Engineering, right? And then, like, how did Panic also make a great ecosystem when so many others have failed? Like, what did they do so right? So it's like, it just sounds like that being nimble in that community is a big part of it.
This is like, at the end of my retrospective, I talk about like the care that has gone into this device. It's simple. It looks silly, right? It's easy to write it off and be like, oh, that's just something they're doing. It's a gimmick. It's not a gimmick. Like they truly made this an ecosystem where people can say, oh, I see a clear path to make a game here. I see a clear path to buy a game here. Like it's just, It works so well. It's so clean. The crank is silly, but it works. It has Hall effect sensors, so it's not going to, you know, it's not going to drift or anything. It's not going to break like that. It's just like that. It's a good piece of hardware. It's solid, and developers can feel that, right? And just adding the crank is so cool. Like, as a developer, if you're kind of stuck in a rut, if you're trying to maybe break into development and you're like, I don't know where to start, this is just fun. And that's a great place to start. So start here. Start where it's fun.
Which is so funny, right? Like, your answer is just they care. Like, it's like, that's how it. They succeed. They care. And that's like an answer to pretty much every like company that may be like trying to break in right now. It's hard. It's very difficult right now. It's so saturated. Most industries are. But like, if we care about the work that we do, that's like one crucial component, I think, to like lasting long and maybe hopefully being successful and caring more about quality than straight pure profit, I think might be also part of it, you know?
It'd be nice.
It would be nice if like capitalism didn't rule our world.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Playdate, for existing. And I feel like this is a good pitch for it. Like, even if you have, I think, hesitation around this thing, like, I'm seeing comments in the chat saying like, yeah, no backlight, it's a deal breaker. I get it. Everything has issues, though. Like, for this, you are buying into a dream, essentially. And it's a fun dream. Like, there are fun games here. You have to deal with some annoyances. And hey, thankfully, something we didn't have back in the Game Boy days is that LEDs are just everywhere. You could buy LED lights for all sorts of stuff. So pretty sure, like, yeah, an LED neck light or something would be enough to help you. Maybe like a nice soft glow light or something would be fine for that. Yeah.
Can I quickly point out, though, that like, just when you mentioned that you already have Netflix like on your TV and whatnot, I have been playing some of the Netflix games on the TV because they just like released that whole like Netflix controller app. Yeah. Uh-huh. And I was trying to play Oxenfree. I couldn't really get into it. I know. Cool, I played this other game that's like Stay With Me or something like this. Basically, these two people trying to leave a spot and you kind of have to like, yeah. So I was playing and like, It works pretty well. And now, like, I feel like even though I don't have a console, I have a gaming option for my big screen, which is kind of nice when I don't want to play the New York Times crossword over and over again. Or when I'm when I sit back on my couch and watch TV, I don't just game. I guess and by game, I mean play the crossword puzzle. I also just crochet. Like, I think I do different things. My brain is looking for small repetitive actions, not
We know, Sherlyn. Totally. We've talked about this.
I know.
I remember my first work trip with Sherlyn was sitting behind her in an airplane. I saw Sherlyn pull up one of the airplane like built-in screen games and do that for 5 hours. She just sat there going, boop.
I can't remember what game it was now. Boop.
I don't know what it was, but that is when I knew, listeners.
I did, yeah.
I was working with a psychopath because who would do that? Who would just... Boop, boop, boop.
You're a real monk.
I did discover Plants vs. Zombies through a backseat airplane monitor, too. So that was like my first intro to Plants vs. Zombies.
Yes.
Yeah.
You talked about
that
forever. This was fun, though.
Yeah.
You were like, I'm a gamer. I play Plants vs. Zombies.
that speaks to, like, hey, people will play games if it is accessible to them.
Yes, easily. Exactly.
Like, I feel like that's it. That's like the Wordle thing, too, in a lot of the New York Times games. People who don't necessarily call themselves gamers will play those things because they pop up within the apps they're already using or something.
Yes, so, exactly.
Hey, we're all gamers. We're all gamers at heart. Except, I don't know, we're not all cool gamers. I would say the CEO, the former CEO of Possibility Space, not a cool gamer.
Oh, yeah.
CEO Jeff Strain. I wrote this story last week, too, and we're just mentioning it here because it is so baffling.
Jeff Strain. Yeah, you're all about this story, so let's hear it. Yeah.
I mean, listen, I covered it because it was like, it was last Friday. We were watching news. Friday's typically not a pretty big news day. We see news, like, happening on Twitter. Austin Walker, former journalist, former games journalist at Waypoint and, you know, Advice and a couple other places. We know he moved over to this indie studio Possibility Space. He was working on something for a long time. He started retweeting people saying, oh, we're done. Like, this company shut down. We are no longer a thing. Those started trickling in. Then we saw news from a whole bunch of folks. Nicole Carpenter from Polygon published a letter that Jeff Strain, the CEO of Possibility Space and the owner of a whole bunch of different studios, it was a letter he sent to the employees saying, like, they basically were made aware that a journalist at Kotaku, a journalist at Kotaku reporter Ethan Gatch, was asking him questions about a confidential game that they were working on. This was a supposed AAA title codenamed Project Vonnegut that they've been working on for years. They never released any details or something. But in his letter, he said he was basically perturbed that this reporter had information about the game. He seemed annoyed that employees were leaking confidential information to the media. And when he relayed this information to an unnamed publisher partner, they basically said they couldn't fund the project anymore, and he shut down the studio. So he essentially blamed a reporter looking into reporting, a reporter like trying to gather details about a game nobody has heard about yet. He blamed that whole thing because they don't know what that piece is going to be, for basically saying they can't trust the employees, and therefore the whole thing shut down. And what makes it even weirder. Yeah, it's okay. So first of all, wild, right, Jess? Like, we've seen a lot of studios shut down. We've seen a lot of news around layoffs. Not normal. Very strange. Yeah,
that's an excuse.
But also last month, last month, his wife, Jeff Strain's wife, Annie DeLisi Strain, who was CEO of like the joint company that held a bunch of these studios, she also closed down Crop Circle Games and blamed the closure again on Kotaku reporter Ethan Gatch, saying like, oh yeah, he was digging around for information. He could have potentially revealed information about my medical condition. Again, no,
he
like,
wouldn't have, yeah, I hope
she didn't see the report. She has no clue what
we
this reporter.
Yeah.
Yeah, we haven't seen it. Nobody has seen it. But just like so she's dealing with multiple sclerosis, which is a horrible thing that she's working through, they're dealing with as a family. It's a tough thing to deal with. It feels really weird to bring that up when a reporter is just trying to like get information about what's happening to your studio. It may not necessarily be like a, you know, gossipy piece about your medical condition, because that's not interesting to Kotaku readers, to be honest. But yeah, she delivered the wildest statement I've ever seen. I stepped down as CEO this winter on a medical leave, and while I don't know the content of Mr. Gatch's article, I have no assurances that my personal health struggles as a rare female game industry CEO will not be covered in this article.
I hate she pulled that card, by the way, and I am calling that a card. Yes, we need more women in authority positions in games, but that is so out of place in this. Just all of this is so out of pocket, but like that especially, that rubs me the wrong way. Like, use that when it's actually relevant, because it's relevant often. There is a lot of discrimination. And that's not what this is.
There was news basically over the past few years, it seems like it was clear that the companies behind them, the companies these folks were in charge of, were dealing with, you know, financial struggles. Like, the entire industry is dealing with it. The entire gaming industry is having trouble, you know, making money and also affording to have a lot of employees, like people overhired during the pandemic for remote work and things like that.
They are making money, to be clear.
Yeah.
They are making more money than ever. Yeah. Okay. Go on.
Yeah. That's true. Public companies are.
Yeah.
But these were smaller studios, essentially. And what is wild is that, they've been dealing with financial trouble for a while. And instead of like being like, hey, this is tough, and we didn't run a very good business, unfortunately, like it was our choices business wise that caused all this to collapse. In both cases, they blamed reporting on it and essentially blamed their employees for talking to a reporter. And therefore, it's your fault that this whole thing collapsed. And I take umbrage with this entire story because it's such bullshit. So that's why I'm all about it, Jess. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Like, there have been so many layoff stories this year already. Already in 2024, 8,800 developers in video games have been laid off. That is wild. There were 10,500 last year, the full year. So like, we're on track to break that depressing record. And this story, though, is like, unlike any other layoff story we've heard. You're totally right. It's wild. It's weird. There's no reason for the things to be public that are public in this conversation, right? If you have issues with your employees talking to reporters, talk to your employees. If you're going to shut down your studio, you can do that, obviously. But like, blaming it on this is kind of nuts. So yeah, I totally see why you were, you know, a little obsessed with it.
It's it's a good story to report on too, just to like, it's a lens to like a certain aspect of the game industry, because this guy, the CEO, Jeff Strain, a couple of years ago was on the record saying, oh yeah, the game studios should unionize, like workers should be unionized, we should have more worker protections. But like, when given given the difficult thing of like dealing with the business that's in trouble, like he chose the, I don't know, the worst way out of it. So that's just super annoying. Anyway, Jess, thank you so much for joining us about this. Anything else you want to mention about things going on in the gaming world?
My preview of Lorelei and the Laser Eyes, which is a game from Sumogo, that'll be coming soon. The preview embargo just lifted kind of willy-nilly. I got an email like, hey, you can publish now. So I've been playing that, and I want to say I'm loving it, but official preview is coming soon.
Awesome. How about one recommendation from you, Jess? It's something people could pick up and play now that we are not really talking about much. Maybe a Switch game, because we know Sherlyn has a Switch. We could get her to have
one. Lorelei and the Laser Eyes. That'll be a Switch game, and that one I highly recommend. It's coming out, I think, in May, so pretty soon. But right now, Children of the Sun is on Steam. I don't think it's on Switch. I think it's just on Steam. But it's a sniper game with like, I'm actually publishing an interview with the developer this week. So I talk about the art style because the art style is neon and sketchy and
so
layered.
Cool.
It's so cool. It's a sniper game where you play as the bullet, basically. You shoot one bullet and then you have to control it as it ricochets across all of its enemies.
Bullet bending, like Wanted.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And then like you get on the leaderboard if you do it quick enough and stylish. And, you know, it's like, but it's also really dark and gritty. Melancholy is the word Renee Rother, the developer, told me. So,
oh, that's cool.
Yeah, good stuff. Children of the Sun on Steam.
All right.
That is up my alley, Jess. I will check that out. Also, I'm sure you saw the news about the Hades 2 tech demo stuff happening. Steam users, if you're on Steam, you can request to get access to that. So you could do that right now. I cannot wait because that looks super cool. So yeah. Okay. Thank you so much, Jess, for joining us. Where can we find you online these days?
Instagram, Jess L. Condit, and Threads. Same thing.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jess.
Welcome to Fail Better, David Duchovny's new podcast with Lemonada Media. On Fail Better, David, who has experienced both low and high profile failures throughout his life, explores the vast world of failure, how it holds us back, propels us forward, and ultimately shapes our lives. Each week, he'll chat with guests like Ben Stiller, Bette Midler, and more about how our perceived failures have actually been our biggest catalysts for growth, revelation, and even healing. Through these conversations, he hopes listeners can learn how to embrace the opportunity of failure and fail better together. Fail Better is out now wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's move on to some other news. And in sad news this week, Boston Dynamics announced that it's killing the Atlas robot. You know, the hydraulic, it killed it. It's retiring it. This is the robot that Boston Dynamics showed off that would like jump around and do all sorts of acrobatics. It did parkour at one point. It has a lot of cables and wires, and it looks like what you would imagine a humanoid robot to look like maybe 10 or 15 years ago, right? Because this thing, it's been around for 11 years. And it's been terrifying us for that long. They retired it, and the language around how Boston Dynamics did that was kind of confusing, because they say specifically, take a look back at everything we've accomplished with the Atlas platform to date, ... It almost seems like there was more to come. And then the next day, just one day later, they announced a new Atlas robot, an all-digital one. The other one was hydraulic, so it had like more wires and stuff going. This new one looks like the robot from, if you've ever seen the Will Smith movie iRobot, which is not a great adaptation of iRobot, but an okay sci-fi movie, it looks almost similar to that. There's no like visible cables. It is just pure machine with like a round face that looks almost like a ring light. I feel like this should be the one for Sherlyn, because it could be a robot that can help you out, but also could be like, hey, let me check my glow up with perfect ring lighting around it. It should be a mirror. I feel like that would be perfect. Did you see the video for this thing, Sherlyn?
I surely did not.
Yes. We can always count Sherlyn for the homework. But if you go to our story, go to Engadget story for the Atlas robot, there's a really short thing showing off like how this thing moves. And it's freaky. It's freaky in the way that you would imagine. It's almost like a horror movie because it's like lying down flat and it stands up. Boston Dynamics says it uses the least movement possible. It has the most efficient movement to do whatever it needs to do. So it kind of like the knees just like buckle up for some, like it had ultimate upper body strength. The knees come up. it comes fully up, instead of like walking around to turn around, it just swivels its hip all around. The head swivels all around because it doesn't need to move like a human, and it doesn't need to move like the old Atlas robot, which had everything like physically in place. So yeah, this is like the robot of our nightmares, right? Because it doesn't even need to turn around. It could just like stop running, do an about face just around its torso, but keep running in the other direction. Truly the ultimate killing machine. This is what it seems like to me. I don't know. What do you think?
The ultimate killing machine was the dog in Black Mirror, okay? And
well, they also have one of
they
those.
They also have that, yes. Around. So Boston Dynamics is like here to make our science fiction nightmares come true. And it's pretty horrifying. But, you know, as Alex Alzona points out in our live chat, there's military and I guess entertainment applications. I mean, I can see the military applications. Entertainment maybe with the, like, I don't know why you would need to swivel like that for entertainment. You could wait for the robot to walk around, you know?
No, well, why should you? Like, that's kind of an interesting thing, right? Why should it have the limitations that humans have or a typical thing does? If it's just like pistons and gears and it can just like, it can rotate on whatever it has, right? So the other one was a test unit that the original Atlas robot, they say, was being tested for like search and rescues for things like that. This one, they're saying it can do all sorts of other things too. So let me see. Here's a quote from Boston Dynamics. They're equipping it to move in the most efficient way possible. It's going to be stronger. It's going to have more movement. There's a new gripper system. It's still parkour capable, but it should be able to lift like heavier things.
We didn't forget the important things like parkour. We just did not. That's good.
In the future, you have to do parkour. In the future, you have to do parkour, lift hard things, and have total upper body strength. And that is the robot that they're building. So good job, Boston Dynamics, which is owned by Hyundai. So Hyundai is doing a lot of work there. Kind of along those lines, too, we saw the news about the Mentibot, another humanoid robot that is it's an AI robot. Even better. Let's make them stronger and humanoid and also put AI in them. This is one that you can command with natural language. This is a very early product. You know, when we talk about Boston Dynamics stuff and Atlas and everything, like those have been in the works for years. That is the company that has so much experience here. Mentee Robotics announced this thing this week, which looks like a very, very simple, has very simple legs, very simple arms. It has like gripper arms that can hold plates. There's somebody in the video like moving plates from side to side. So it can do things, but it seems a lot dumber. And the big hook is that it's AI powered. So just like the humane AI pin, Trillin, it'll be just as functional and useful as that, right?
Sure, yeah. Not going to like fall apart when you ask it for the weather or something, sure.
Not at all. This is probably a good point to talk about the idea of humanoid robots and the usefulness of these things. Like, is this something you guys think you would want to have in your home after a certain point? Like, if it could load the dishwasher and take care of daily tasks, would that be a thing you want in your home? Because I sure would. That would be a thing I would love to stop doing myself.
I wonder where it comes from, right? This desire to, like you said, make humanoid robots. Like, is it because we need our robots to look familiar to us? Do we want a human-shaped thing to issue commands to? Is that not just reminiscent of some other oppression, you know? Why couldn't we just have square cart-looking things that have moving arms that helped us stock our shelves or something like that, or like helped us, like you said, load the dishwasher? Why does it have to look like human? Why can't it look like a little Bali?
Maybe
like the Samsung Bali, you know?
If you've been to like a grocery store recently, Sherlyn, where they have like Stop and Shops in my old neighborhood in Flatbush, Brooklyn, they had like this security patrolling robot. It's just like this big thing that would roll around the store with a camera and like keep an eye on things. Everybody hated it. But it's like this weird presence that's around. I could see the argument being our spaces are built for human size,
sure, needs,
right? Like, so that you walk around, there's not always space. You know, like, accessibility is a big problem in all of our environments. So we need things with mobile legs. We need things.
Yes,
that are,
but
like,
why do we need a head shaped thing? You know what I mean? Like,
why do you need a head shaped thing? Maybe that's just to make you feel more comfortable.
Right, exactly.
Right?
You
I
know
like
where
that's
to
just
look,
a comfort
I guess.
Thing. But I can imagine, like, listen, there are things I have to do. I've offloaded a lot of tasks. I don't know about you, Sherlyn, but when I grew up, chores were like a big thing, and my parents were always doing like random, like we were always in the yard taking care of stuff, we were always cleaning the house, we were always doing stuff. Well, you were cleaning the house, I hope, I don't know, but there was always tasks. And now, like, I've tried to offload as much busy work as I can so I can actually spend time with my kids so they can have a fun childhood that's not built of just, like, cleaning the house. But the one thing I still have to do is spend an hour in my kitchen every night just cleaning everything and loading the dishwasher and unloading the dishwasher and making sure the cats are good and making sure, like, all this stuff is happening. So if you could have a house robot that could just do some of those things, I think that would be useful for a lot of people, but I don't know what it would take for us to get to that point. So, you know, listeners, let us know. Would you ever use a humanoid robot, or are you afraid of what, you know, the society that could happen that was portrayed in the Matrix, the Animatrix? Was it the Second Renaissance? The whole backstory of what led to the Matrix was essentially, we made these robots and it was good. And then we really, really treated them badly. And then they achieved a certain sense of, AI, a certain sense of their own personalities. And then they were like, no, we don't like being treated like crap. And then they revolted. So I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. But it's interesting to see all these companies kind of play around with it. I'm not super interested with the AI idea. That's just me. I don't trust it. It's certainly after the humane AI pin. Just doesn't seem like it's going to be a good thing. Sherlyn, did you see the story about NASA confirming that an object that pierced a Florida man's roof is actually space trash?
I did not. When did this happen, actually? March 8th?
That the confirmation was this week, and the news is it was part of a cargo pallet that the space station dropped in 2021, and back then there was a report that this object had basically ripped through this guy's house, like through the roof, through several floors, missed his son, who was like in the house at the time. It's just a 1.6-pound object, but if it's falling from such a great height that it just, like, pierces through everything, seems like a problem. NASA says it's going to be looking into why this happened. Their modeling typically says, like, for a part that's as small as this, it should burn up in the atmosphere. If they eject it from the space station and, like, goes off to Earth, it should burn up as it's hitting the atmosphere, and that just didn't happen in this case, so... that's just terrifying. It reminds me of Donnie Darko, where, you know... plane debris just falls in your house and kills you. Can happen at any point. There's just danger in the skies, right?
Yeah, it's scary. I mean, I do remember the story, and I remember seeing the like piece of debris in the picture and not even connecting that it is like space debris, and that if like that's exactly what fell into someone's like home and tore through the roof and everything and potentially hurt, you know, someone. It just feels like there's A, the problem of space debris, B, a lot going on that could hurt us outside of like even our planet, you know?
There's so much. Literally, we have to worry about all the things on the planet that can kill us. And also, COVID is still a thing. Also, you know, political instabilities, climate change,
so much.
Everything, killer bugs.
This is the good place.
Just really hurt us. Yeah.
This is what the good place was saying about like, the world's gotten so much more complicated than ever, you know?
Anyway. Also, another news, and I feel like this is going to be a good one for a lot of us. Sony seems to be getting rid of the super annoying naming conventions that they use. They're naming models. When we talk about like Sony's great noise-canceling headsets, I'm talking about the WH-1000XM3, right? That was the one that really got us all going. Now there's the XM4 and then there's the XM5. But Sony also has wireless earbuds, and those are the WF-1000XM number.
Mm-hmm.
And it's annoying as hell.
Don't forget, Sony, then they have the extra bass line, which is not this like 1000X series, which is their flagship, right? So
the
then they have the
one.
Extra bass, which is XB, whatever the hell, something other alphanumeric. And
those model numbers were like SRS XV900, SRS XG300.
Yeah.
Just really get excited about all the, and these were like all different products. They were headphones, they were speakers, they were
TVs, I think.
Seems like a mess.
Yeah.
Yeah. It always seemed like to me, Sherlyn, it's such like a Japanese company thing, right? Where like they have a logic for it, right? And we're doing it this way because we've done it this way for decades. And that is how Sony works. I think Nintendo tends to have this problem sometimes too. But it's just like things that are so archaic and impenetrable to normal consumers, right? Except for hi-fi nerds or something. They'll just go with it because that's what they've always done. And what's interesting here is Billy Steele has a story saying like, hey, that's changing. Sony last week debuted a ULT lineup of speakers and headphones, ULT, which have specific types of names. So the ULT Tower are large party speakers. The ULT V field or small Bluetooth speakers, you'll wear our headphones. At least that makes sense.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. And the ULT, so the alt line replaces, I believe, the extra bass line. So it's like still, is their mid-range, like thumpier bass sort of line, but not their high-end 1000X that we love. Who knows what's going to happen to those, by the way, but I would be extremely happy to no longer have to be like, Sony WF-1000XM4 is our favorite. Like, just the Sony high-end, whatever one word thing.
Annoying. Yeah, their new TVs, by the way, are also much simpler than they used to be. So the TVs were the most annoying things in the world, Trillin, because it was like the XR65A95L. And every year they would get a little different. And you could decode it a little bit. Like you could see 65 in there. Okay, 65 inch, sure. 95L is like the type of screen it is. And it's just like, what are you doing, Sony? So their new TVs are just Bravia 9,
yes.
Bravia 8. Bravia 7, yes. Even within that, they're a little confusing because the Bravia 9 are the mini LED models, which are going to be super bright. The Bravia 8 are the OLED models, which I would argue I would put above mini LED, to be honest. Like, they won't be as bright, but they look better to me personally, like contrast-wise. Okay, even within that, there's confusion. But okay, good job, Sony, for finally getting, I don't know, a little more modernized. Billy gave us some background on this, too. Like, he was talking about... he was hearing from people at Sony, like even the executives were like, they would run into trouble where the people, the product managers, the people higher ups at Sony would have trouble referring specifically to the right models.
To be clear, he's guessing, like the wording in his thing is he would wager that people at Sony itself also got confused. So, you know, that's a... I wouldn't be surprised, like, if there were times during briefings where, like, people would say the wrong name themselves, you know, employees.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. Yeah. That happened to me at several Sony briefings, so I can confirm that happened.
Yeah, exactly.
Sony gave us a brief statement saying the main reason for Sony's new naming convention is to expand recognition by adopting a more memorable and understandable name for consumers. No shit, Sony. Thank you. Thank you for that comment, and thank you for finally making this move that you should have made, I don't know, decades ago. So
finally,
we don't know what the new headphones are called. We were expecting the WH-1000XM6 and the WF-1000XM6 this year, and maybe those were going to have better names, and I don't know. Maybe they're just going to be clearer, but sit tight. I'm also seeing some good deals on those headphones. So, you know, if you see the XM5s or 4s floating around for a good price, probably a good time to snap them up too.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Let's move on to what we're working on. I'm juggling a couple of reviews right now. I don't know what is up with the Microsoft Store, but like, I ordered the Surface Pro 10 and the Laptop 7 for business, both of them. Pre-ordered them weeks ahead of the release, never shipped. And they're like, oh, I call them. They're like, oh, yeah, your just payment just never worked out. I'm like, oh, dude, would you like to tell me that?
Yeah.
Would you like to tell me that this order can't be completed? Anyway, I fixed that. I'm going to be getting that soon to review. That's really annoying. I'm also in the process of reviewing the Dell XPS 13 and 14, the new ones. Kind of interesting, but also very much like the XPS 16. So, you know, that's where I'm at. Trillin, what's going on with you?
I have been passive aggressively sending my to-do list to certain members on the team because some people have been like, I wonder what you do all day. No, nobody has actually said that. Nobody's actually coming.
I wonder that. Yeah.
I do. Yeah. Well, you'll get a screenshot on my to-do list. It's just a lot of like, you know, background stuff that doesn't show up on the site, which is why, like, you know, I mentioned what last week that like, if I don't have bylines showing up on the site, doesn't mean I've been slacking off. It just means stuff I do is not stuff you all might see yet.
I mean, you're doing the work of an editor. This is what editors do.
Right. Anyway,
mostly background. Yeah.
We've done some, you know, events planning for the spring summer event season. So, you know, upcoming events like Google I/O or Microsoft Build, there's like WWDC, all of those dates were announced. So we're doing some planning around that. And I've got some like fun ideas for Engadget reviews in general coming up. So actually, if you're listening and tuning in, just you have any ideas on what you'd like to see more in reviews across the internet in general, especially for tech products, you send them my way because I'd love to claim credit for your ideas. Send them to Sherlyn at podcasts. I don't know, Sherlyn at Engadget.com or podcast at Engadget.com or whatever. And then, yeah, after the humane AI pin, you know, like birthing that monster, I just feel... feel very drained. I feel like I don't want to write for a little bit. So there you go.
I mean, you came in to like put the smackdown on this thing. And also, by the way, like slight update to the humane AI pin. Now people are mad at Marcus Brownlee about his review. And let me just say, I have not seen a company devolve into sheer whining so quickly as Humane, because like a lot of people working there now are like, some people said the reviews were fair. And then yeah. I saw things starting to get really like, Maybe Marcus Brownlee has a little too much power. Maybe these tech reviewers are just killing companies. And it's like, guys, make good stuff. Make good shit. It's simple.
Basically. It's so funny because Marquez isn't doing anything he hasn't been doing, in the past. He's just...
Well, this came right after the Fisker thing, too. So I feel agree, like right after extra the... sensitive.
But yeah. He even like just took it on. Like I think the part of the issue is, so for publications, I feel like maybe people have a bit less of an issue. But I think part of the issue here is that the way YouTube influencers or individual entities get product is that sometimes they are paid to do a review. Mm-hmm. And then in mm-hmm. that case, the ethics get so dicey. I think that's where people might get angrier. And I think when you have a following as large as
Marquez's.
That
wasn't the case here though.
Yeah. I agree. I understand. This was, yeah, Humane this was didn't like pay legit anyone. Criticism. Yeah. And Marquez has always been fair with his criticism. We've crossed paths, but I don't know him personally, but he's always come, mm-hmm. like, I know people on his team, right? So I know that they're like what their ethics is like, somewhat similar to ours. So it's like, they're just here to give their fair criticism.
I trust those folks. There are a lot of YouTubers I don't trust because they do a lot of those pay-per-views.
Exactly. Very shady stuff.
Which is the weirdest thing is because then I see audiences being totally fine with that. Like, totally, I trust this person, even though they're being paid by this company to say things about their product. Mm-hmm. Anyway, mm-hmm. this is a side rant.
Anyhow.
But, hey, tech reviewers are not killing companies. The company's bad products are killing companies. That's what's happening.
I will say, like I mentioned, like a lot of the work that I've been doing is like editing stuff. The lot of stuff has gone up this week around the team as well. Not just like, you know... from people that get to write, but also people that get to edit. Sam reviewed the Asus ROG Zephyrus G16 this week. It's the 16-inch version of the G14 he reviewed last week, and actually gave it a slightly lower score than the G14. So in this case, bigger did not mean better. Sam also published a rant about X's AI not being able to tell apart vandalism from a bad game. So... go read that. I thought it was really an interesting follow to something that was happening in the news. And then just like this week, like I said, like we were talking about all those robots just now in other news. I had like so much fun like tweaking our homepage this week because there was one day where I was like, oh, this is the thing I want to put in the main slot. This is the one. And then I was like, wait, everything is robots. It was like everything a robot themed news week. And that was really fun. And all the headlines were pretty good too. I think they knocked it out of the park with the Boston Dynamics retirement home headline too. So just shout out. I think we're trying to be better with our headlines and it seems like it's showing.
It's showing. I feel like the thing that my disappointment with Boston Dynamics is that they should have introduced the new robot basically walking in mm-hmm. and like uppercutting the head off.
Stomping on the, yeah.
just like tearing it apart. I am the new Atlas. Really, there's your opportunity. Put them in the Rock'em Sock'em Robots like ring or something and just go punch, 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 new winner, new Atlas. So many opportunities for fun times, but maybe they don't want to show these things being too violent yet. Their actual secret abilities to kill humans. I don't know.
We'll Who get knows? That soon.
Who there. Knows? Any pop culture picks for us this week, Sherlyn?
Yes. So other than those fun Netflix games I mentioned, I actually last night or the night before watched the documentary on HBO called Brandy Helville and the Cult of Fast Fashion. if you have not been around, you know, the like just general like streetwear or fashion, fast fashion sort of brands, you might not have heard of Brandy Melville. But for me, my like early experiences shopping in America for clothes for myself, Brandy Melville was a big brand. Like I would look and I would be like, oh, we would, you know, the stuff is soft and stretchy. And it, the whole like approach there is one size fits all. They only have one size. And the Brandy Melville aesthetic is very like skinny, thin, white or fair skinned.
That's how it's one size fits all. Like,
and that's what they describe as one size fits all. Exactly. Yeah. That's there. And then so like watching, going into this, I already knew it was going to be kind of toxic, right? But the documentary just keeps getting worse. It was just worse and worse. Like I was like, this is sick. And I was like, whoa, this is sickening. And then, whoa, this is perverted. Like it just got worse and worse. I mean, come for the like Brandy Melville story and I guess stay for like the just general commentary on fast fashion that we already kind of knew. But what I like about this documentary is that at the end, it actually shows kind of potential solutions, things we can do. And some of them are obvious, you know, like buy secondhand or like, you know, buy clothes without the mentality that you're going to like grow out of them in 2 years or throw them out. You know, buy clothes that will last, right? Like, that's the whole reason fast fashion exists, is because people were brainwashed to think that it's not a good idea to wear the same thing over and over. And I'm like, no, I buy the same black turtleneck. I have the three, you know, black turtlenecks. I just wear them over and over again. Like, that's fine. No one should be judging anyone.
You want to be Steve Jobs. We get it. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, maybe not black, but I just try to change out the colors. But anyway, so it was really interesting. I think that documentary was a really good look for me into that Brandy Melville sort of background as well as the fashion and clothing industry.
Awesome. Awesome. What's wild, Sherlyn, is like, I'm not a fashion, you know, person, but I actually do spend more time thinking about like, you know, okay, I need some new clothes for summer or something. Like, but apparently more than most guys, like just talking to people around me, I've never heard of this brand before. What the hell?
Brandy Melville?
I help my wife buy clothes because she also doesn't buy clothes for herself. But also she is probably doesn't look like she's the sort of person that this clothing line would even like think about fitting for. So just wild. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's cool. Mm-hmm. I want to recommend something which I think will appeal to a lot of our listeners, and it is called Hundreds of Beavers. Do you like cartoons? Do you like live action cartoons? This is like a cult film that's been going around theaters around the US over the past few months, directed by Mike Cheslick. Essentially, it's about an Applejack salesman who goes from zero to hero and becomes a fur trapper, trying to trap all the beavers that destroyed his Applejack factory. But it is done in black and white and very DIY and low budget. And it is very cartoony. It is very like slapstick humor. It is very like Bugs Bunny type of stuff. It's really funny. It's really funny, and it's a good time, and you can buy it and rent it on video on demand right now. It is not like a mature work of comedy or anything. It is pure slapstick cartoonish comedy, but it's a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of like Molly and Max in the Future that I recommended a couple of weeks ago. It's really cool to see these like lo-fi independent visions of filmmaking out there that also you could just easily buy. And also it seems like I hear the crowd screenings at the theaters are doing pretty well too. So if you can see this with a crowd, that's even better. But I think more people will actually end up seeing it on video on demand. It's a lot of fun. So check out Hundreds of Beavers. It's available wherever you rent stuff, buy stuff digitally right now.
Well, that's it for our episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. This podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Twitter, Mastodon, Blue Sky, all over the place. And I podcast about movies and TV at The Filmcast at thefilmcast.com.
If you want to send me either non-fast fashion labels or your best review ideas that I can steal, I am at Sherlynlo on X or at Sherlinstagram on Instagram and Threads. You can also email me at chgr@engadget.com. Email us your thoughts at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review, please, on iTunes or your podcast platform of choice, and subscribe anywhere you get podcasts.